G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 332nd. It's on. My name's Dick Newman. Let's get on with it. And if you'd like a bit more of that, and why wouldn't you? You were listening to Trio Mandilli, which means three women's headscarves. Yeah, but it's actually three women from Georgia, and they were singing Psalm 50. It's about how naughty I've been, but hey, God, you're a nice guy, so do me a solid and wash that sin right on out of me. Unlike Benjamin Netanyahu, who said that the Palestinians are the Amalek. I doubt that, though, unless you, my dear listener, can tell me you've seen those Palestinians drinking blood. You see, Amalek are blood-drinking descendants of Esau. Oh, nasty people. God really does not like this mob, the Amalek, which Benjamin Netanyahu tells us are the Palestinians. So God said, go all genocide on. God would be really cross with King Saul, who failed to kill their king, Agag, and the best livestock of the Amaleks. Now, genocide, my dear listener, means all living things. So look out, Palestinian puppies and kittens. The Israelis are coming for you. It is all so awful, my dear listener. It really is dreadful over there at the moment. But Benjamin Netanyahu is quoting that stuff against the Palestinians. That's not helpful at all. Yeah, this religion stuff's fine if you just sing about it, but when you start quoting Deuteronomy like the bloody Israelis, crikey, well. Last week, we got the American Revolution just about started, with the main point being that the wealthy elite came up with the grand ideals that, sadly in reality, might be a little bit meaningless, like freedom, but no democracy just yet. The idea is that the present overarching government in Westminster is bad for us, and I can't disagree with them on that. So to make everyone happy, we need a new government of we American types, and I can pretty much disagree with that if I feel like it. This mob were in it for the toys that they could have if they belted the English out and took over the place. We finished up, though, back with George and trying to see if we could find a mistress or some sort of floozy even, but we couldn't find any credible evidence for any girls like that. So it looked like George was just into Charlotte and that was it. George will be described as a Philistine, the word Philistine not being used as a capital P noun here. No, a capital P Philistine, the noun, refers to a native or inhabitant of ancient Philistia. And what do we call those parts today? Well, Palestine, southern parts of Palestine. Places like Ascalon, Ashdod, Gath, Ekron and Gaza. The Philistines may have originated from Crete, hanging out there about 3,200 years ago. And Crete had just become the place to produce bronze. The Philistines wanted to expand, so came into contact with the Israelites, and believe it or not, these two mobs started building into each other. The Philistines, of course, were totally superior in technology. They had smiths, and that gave them military dominance for a couple hundred years. More, they will manage to take over some of the hill country, but then in comes shepherd boy David, who will do over the Philistine giant Goliath. Then when he grows up, David as king will have victories over the Philistines. The Philistines were in trouble, and their kingdom was gone, but their cities remained. It'll only take a couple of generations and the Israelites are infighting, so the place will split into Israel and Judea, and the Philistines are back to having kind of their own country down there. The Greek marketing department will change the name of the place to Palestine and the people's names to Palestinians. 300 years after that, we start that round of Assyrians, Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, and finally Romans. And Palestine and the Palestinians are subject to the same T's and C's as the Jews with those empires. The Romans crack the total shits for the Jews, boot them out of Jerusalem, and change the name of the whole place to Syria Palestina. 1918, in come a bunch of Jews to much unhappiness. Wealthy Palestinians had been selling land to the Jews. The common smelly Palestinian tenants were told to just piss off. Tensions rose. 1947, and Europe comes up with a partition plan, a two-state solution. Ah, that sounds all right. We'll have Israel and Palestine. Fuck, that said the Jews, and it was war, with the Jews declaring independence on the same day. At the end of the war, the Jews held more land than the proposal on the mandate, so no separate Palestine state was created. We would have had to ask the Jews to give some back, please. Yeah, that wasn't going to happen. Enough, because that is all just a very rough look, and it wasn't in the context in which George has been caught. But I'm just saying that if a Palestinian was to say to me that my family had lived in Gaza for 5,200 years, I wouldn't be able to say, well, no, he hasn't. Because it could be true. Back to England. George is being called a small p Philistine. And once again, I think it's wrong. A person guided by materialism and is usually disdainful of intellectual or artistic values, or one uninformed in a special area of knowledge. Now, I've got no idea why he was called a Philistine, and still is by some people. His dad, Fred, was a patron of the arts, while Mum, Augusta, was very into architecture. Apart from the parents' influence, his tutor also taught young George architecture and had him doing drawings 3 mornings a week. The tutor also kept him appraised of new archaeological discoveries. His mentor, Bute, was also a major art collector. George will do the odd bit of designing himself, like door cases for the Queen's Palace. These are hand-carved fancy bits to go around door frames. Drawing and designing will help George get through his illness. Order and harmony helped. He designed houses and came up with other plans. This will catch on as a hobby for the rich and famous, copying the king, not only in Britain, but also in America. Thomas Jefferson might want to tell everyone that George is a big fat turd, but he'll take up the designing hobby. George also had lessons in perspective drawing. He was a major collector of books, arts, maps, music, and scientific equipment. George bought a few major collections. An art and book collection from a guy, Joseph Smith, who had been a consul in Venice. The collection will include 500 paintings and drawings, as well as coins and gems. George will also pick up the collection of Cardinal Alessandro Albani, and this stuff can go to the Queen's Palace. So there's a lot of Italian stuff in those two collections alone. That is just what we needed at the time, though. Our national art collection needed the classical works of Catholic Europe. George is also commissioning artists to come up with history works, like Timon of Athens and the departure of Regulus from Rome. Oh, groan, but I get it. Timon rejected luxury and materialism, while Regulus was a noble, self-sacrificing hero of Rome. Yeah, dickhead as well. George was also a strong supporter of the Royal Academy. He will donate from the privy purse. George is a big fan of the American artist Benjamin West. He'd gained a reputation as a history painter, and before you know it, he is historical painter to the king. 6 paintings will come out of this for the Queen's Palace. The American war brewing will be a bit of a problem for Benjamin, but he'll be okay. He's pretty English by now, and he married an English woman. He will knock out the Battle of the Boyne and the destruction of the Frenchy fleet at La Hougue, which were a couple of wins for William III over Louis XIV. That also helped his popularity. George is, like us, a big fan of Baby Ted, Edward III, so we'll get Benjamin West to do up some Baby Ted paintings. Right, now we have Edward III crossing the Somme and the Burghers of Calais. Now, the Burghers of Calais should not be confused with the Burghers of Calais statue by Rodin, which is in a park outside the Houses of Parliament, if my memory is working today. Those Burghers of Rodin really look like they need a feed. They look like they have come out of a fortification that's been under siege for a long time. But the Burghers of Calais in the West painting have Philippa asking baby Ted to be merciful. That's nice. Time for the churchy stuff, and George will commission 36 pictures on the progress of revealed religion. Oh, dear me. 18 will be done, but the overall project includes a new royal chapel at Windsor, and that won't be built. The point of all this is George was the champion of historical paintings, and handy with the religious paintings at a time when art patrons were not into that stuff. If it hadn't been for George, we might not have any of it. George would also build a quasi-private library. It's open to scholars. This will end up having 65,000 books by the time he died. Along with books will be 19,000 tracts and pamphlets and the first decent collection of maps and charts. And a lot of that stuff was also funded by the Privy Purse. George will patronise authors too. Our dictionary writer, Samuel Johnson, will become an advisor on which books to purchase, and he will write, "The ascension of George III to the throne of these kingdoms opened a brighter prospect to men of literary merit who had been honoured with no mark of royal favour in the preceding reign. His present majesty's education in this country, as well as his taste and benefice, prompted him to be a patron of the science and arts." Yeah, see, that's not a Philistine, that guy, George. George and Charlotte were also into music. Kitty Mozart will play three times for them. They'll invite Beethoven a few times, but yeah, he's busy. Yeah, he's in demand, this guy, so he didn't come to London. Haydn will turn up, but George wasn't into modern music, sadly. Johann Christian Bach will turn up when Charlotte organised a concert for him to perform at. James Hatfield will shoot George at a concert. What? No, I've strayed well and truly in the future, 1800, in fact, and so we'll come back to James and his pot shot at George in the fullness of time. The point I've been struggling to make, though, is that George is no Philistine, neither big P Philistine or small P Philistine. He was, in fact, a supporter of the arts and sciences. A little bit of music there from a Bhangra dancing clip. Nothing cheers you up quite like watching some Bhangra dancing. But back to the past, and there's been an invention, my dear listener. A marvellous thingy called the helm wheel. You can call it a steering wheel if you like, or the ship's wheel. That is where you'll find it, with a crusty old sea salt saying, "Steady as she goes," or whatever. We aren't sure when exactly humans came up with this, but when you turn it, it turns the rudder head, and that turns the rudder. Thing is, by the time George III got his bum on the big chair, it was pretty much established technology. That, on top of the fact that we are forever popping back and forwards between England and America, made the trip way more safe and predictable. So we all think George should have visited America. Now, that's all well and good, but it may not have helped at all. Thing is, we'll never know. Things like not sending an Anglican bishop to New England might have helped more. George was looking to maintain royal authority in America. "I'm the king and will be obeyed" type bullshit. It is the money thing. The cost of America was pretty substantial. He was keen on the stamp tax to solve the monetary problem and was not happy with Rockingham's compromise that abandoned the tax. Not helping George were English accusations that he was being despotic in his attitude and policies. That inflamed the Americans, who were happy to go on the tack on similar lines. That is, he's being despotic. George maintains some credit in America. He was very welcome after his granddad George II, and not all of the popularity has worn off. We had the 7 Years' War, or the French and Indian War, if you want to be America, and that accumulated some big debts. At the end of the war, the debt problem meant a need to focus on America. George seemed to be, though, more interested in the new acquisitions, Canada from the Frenchies and Florida from the Spaniards. He also thought it would be a good idea to just pop 10,000 troops over in America, ready in case the Frenchies invade. Obviously, those troops will be there to benefit the Americans, and so, of course, it's only right that they should pay for them. And, again, here's the problem, is George has got no friggin' idea, really, what's going on over the place, and what's the tax people. What's a senior minister's 10,000? That's a bit much, George, and will cost those Americans an absolute bundle. Besides, George, have you thought about how much power the minister in charge of them will be? Yeah. You're about to have a minister with 10,000 hard men, mate. Meanwhile, over in America, the big dicks are finding their ears burning. Is someone talking about us? They will, of course, find out that, yes, the king and the ministers are talking about America, and the American big dicks would be happy if they all just shut up. Even so, we still like George, but not those evil advisers who are back. Oh, no, it's the evil advisers. The big dicks will calm down when Grenville is sacked as Prime Minister and Rockingham comes in to repeal the Stamp Act. George will be praised for that. Townsend will introduce his duties and the American big dicks are back to, oh, the ministry is corrupt. If you recall, we had that radical journalist Wilkes writing against George in London and some Americans were supporting his stuff, but overall, George still has the support of the Americans. The Americans have totally got on board with newspaper idea and are leading the way in it. Printing in Europe is actually going crazy. In the 15th century, Europe knocked out bugger all printed books, really. The 16th century, they knocked out 200 million, the 17th century, 500 million, and the 18th century, 1,000 million books will be printed. In America, like England, newspapers have been a bit of a sideline for printers. It kicked off in 1704 when the governor approved the Boston New Letter to be published. It was a weekly newspaper and pretty soon the idea was copied in New York and Philadelphia. Readers will say, oh great, we can write letters to the editor. And what will they write about? Well, they'll be criticising the governor. And the governor will say, hey, guess what, I can shut the papers down. In New York, it'll be an action for libel against John Zenger for his satirical attacks on the government. Not bloody guilty, say the jury. They like this stuff. By 1760, there were 24 weekly newspapers operating, with most of them having satirical attacks on the government. Yeah, we really like it. How different from our own times, where the media just seem to be the bloody mouthpiece of the government, or their political party, at least. If not the government. Back then, though, these newspapers will ramp up with patriotic fervour, ready for the revolution. Yeah, obviously it's big business or wealthy merchants who own the papers, so yeah, they want the revolution. The government, of course, is pro-Britain, because that's the governors, the British appointed governors, so there will be plenty of anonymous political commentators. These all paved the way for Thomas Paine and his common sense thingy. But it's not just the Americans. The commander of the British Army in America will complain that anti-British newspapers just get copied and Americanized before printing. The media is whipping up the mob, is the complaint of the government. 1774, and George's reputation is under pressure. What's the problem right now? Oddly enough, it's the East India Company. What? Did we find they bring in a shit ton of cash? Well, yeah, but the question is, where does the cash go? Dividends to shareholders, that's where it's going. And, of course, lots of our politicians are on that gravy train. They're happy with the way things are going. In the meantime, could the government please stuff up the cash for British troops to be stationed in India? So you've got the company making money, but the government isn't getting any, and they're stumping up the cash for army types in India. But in America, different situation. We want America to stump up that cash. On top of that, tea demand in Britain is down. Hey, what the fuck's going on? The Poms have gone off the tea. We don't understand why, but they have. They've gone off it. So that revenue is well below expectation. Can we come up with an idea? We always can. We can always come up with an idea. Doesn't mean it's going to be a good one, but let's see what this one is. Okay, we'll get the Americans to import our tea and then they can pay the import duties. Isn't that great? That way we can then pay their government types directly, meaning they won't need their colonial assemblies. Yeah, they don't have to have any parliaments or any say, because we can run the place for them. Great, they should love that. But of course they do not love it at all. Nor will they like it when other duties get introduced. As for tea, well, there's Dutch smugglers operating, so the Americans can continue to get cheap tea without any duties, thank you. And so all this will spiral and end up with the Sons of Liberty, led by Samuel Adams, tossing 340 chests of tea into the Boston Harbour. And why they're dressed as Native Americans is just a bit beyond me, but they did. There you go. Another item contributing to the revolution was those Americans having their first Great Awakening. Hallelujah, brothers and sisters. We sent off a lot of Puritans to that place, so what the fuck did we expect? Perhaps we thought baby Jesus would pop in and say, hey guys, the Anglican religion is the right religion. But baby Jesus didn't pop in to say that. So it'll be travelling evangelists with their revivals. Yep. This is an American thing because it wasn't only the British colonists swept up in it. The Dutchie and the German migrants were all part of the Great Awakening. Well, not all necessarily. I'm generalising, aren't I? There were lots of Germans and Dutchies who were also in the Great Awakening. Hosanna, my dear listener. The whole thing will catch on bigly. Pastors change their sermons. Dense theological sermons are out. And nothing is taboo. We are here to provide unbiased and uncontrolled, uncontrolled information to the congregation. Rhetoric is in. We want to persuade you to accept whatever message we are selling. One thing we want now is religious freedom. It's up there on our list of wants, and George is just offering a bit of Anglicanism. Rumours are out that George will send in a big old bunch of bishops to sort us out. That rumour will not make the Americans happy at all. We think that George will then force the population to convert to the Anglican stuff. Oh no, that's disgusting. Things are not helped either by rapid population growth. The authorities didn't increase the amount they were spending on the poor to compensate for the growth. The poor might be happy to try their luck west of the Appalachians, but that is off limits thanks to the English government. For a lot of people, the revolution will be less about freedom and democracy and more about British policy being a bit all over the place, and we don't know what they might do next and what do they know about America anyway. Living in London doesn't help you understand local issues and conditions. Whatever policies the British will come up with, we can be pretty certain they'll involve taxes for us to pay for their army, which we didn't really want. We don't want their army. Thanks. Can you take it back? In fact, they're right. George and the government think there's just a few troublemakers in America. No big deal. George and the government also see the 13 colonies as distinct and independent. Now, that would be a correct assessment of how they were set up, but as each has a crisis, which they all will have crisis, they start to look to team up with the others. They're realising their strength in numbers and becoming a cohesive group is a good idea. You want to retain your state independence, but also have this big umbrella that you're part of. A uniting of the states is occurring and George can't see it. George thinks that any concessions he gives to the Americans would be seen as a sign of weakness. You know, these dickheads with their "we've got to be a strong man" thing just doesn't work. We can't have any signs of weakness, and what those colonial chappies need is a firm hand. They need a bit of stick to calm down the conspiracy and agitation. No, George, it's not conspiracy and agitation that are brewing. They've been done. They're done and dusted. Now it's revolution brewing. You're late on the case, mate. When the Massachusetts Charter was revoked, putting control back to England, the other 12 colonies took it all personally. If it happened to Massachusetts, then it could happen to us. The opposition in Britain had said, hey, hang on, this is a bit bloody excessive. But the colonies know the vote, which was 182 in favour and 49 against. So, yeah, it's a big majority. George thought that was brilliant. The colonies thought it was terrible. It was a hit with the mob as well. The English mob, of course, not the American mob. Such a hit that George dissolved Parliament a year early so we could have an election. If you're a government, then having an election just after you've had a nice big win with the common smellies is great. So we did just that. It may be all nice in England, but in America the situation was deteriorating and hostility to the British growing. More troops are sent to Massachusetts and General Thomas Gage will be told to use force to restore royal authority. They'll get the ball rolling, and before you know it, George is writing that the New England governments are in a state of rebellion. Blues must decide whether they are subject to this country or independent. New England, if I haven't mentioned, is six states in the northeastern United States. Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island and Vermont. And England was saying it is these states causing the problems, with the rest mostly under our control. But not everyone agrees with that view. George knows what the problem is. It was the repeal of the Stamp Act which made Britain look weak. He wants to go in harder. He should read Thomas Jefferson, who wrote A Summary View of the Rights of British America. That these are our grievances which we have thus laid before His Majesty, with the freedom of language and sentiment which becomes a free people, claiming their rights as derived from the laws of nature and not as the gift of their chief magistrate. It's pretty hard to reconcile that sort of writing with I'm the king and will be obeyed type sentiments. Worse? Well, read on. Kings are the servants, not the proprietors of the people. Oh dear, George won't like that. Open your breast, sire, to liberal and expanded thought. Now, see, Tom already told you, George does not like this free-thinking, new idea type stuff. Thomas Jefferson is advocating that the empire is like the American state, a series of parts, each with its own rights, under the umbrella, the care of the crown. All the Irish like that idea, they'll be supporting that, and there's actually support for it in England as well. It will eventually actually happen, because it is a good idea. It will take time, but the British will see the sense and appoint colonial governors to be politically responsible to local legislators and not to London. But that's going to be all too late for this case. The Henley Street Country Club letting George know it's too late, baby. Finally, the British, or at least some of the British, will get it. We do need to compromise or face rebellion. So the deal is that if America pays for its own government and a decent defence force, then there will be no more British taxes. But yes, that ban was correct. It is too late. Right, that's a good deal, but it's too late. The Continental Congress has formed, it's met, and it's made its own decisions, like we won't be having British legislation. Hey, Poms, we are loyal and all that, but no, we're over it. Besides, the Americans had done too good a job of whipping up the common smellies to stop violence. It'll go against the wealthy elite unless it's channeled towards the English army. So we get back to Concord and Lexington, and the British are coming, and dead soldiers. When the army got to Concord, the militia were well and truly outnumbered, and so they'd actually started to disperse. They were just going to go away. But a shot was fired. Who fired that shot, my dear listener? Well, who knows? Nobody knows. But somebody fired a shot, and that brought a salvo from the British, and it's on. When the dust settles, the Americans are, of course, outraged. British authority will collapse elsewhere in the 13 colonies, with the army being massed at Massachusetts. That's where the action is. Governors are pretty much on their own. Even now, it's a minority of Americans who really want the independence thing, but the minority is rather passionate, so it's they who will ensure that no compromise with Britain will get the tick. The Americans will come up with a response to the British offer, but George won't be coming up with anything to challenge American viewpoints. God has appointed him as king, and that's it, guys. God appointed me. In comes a petition from America. George will refuse to read it. And yes, I know, the petition is one of our sacred rights, one of those freedoms that the Americans bang on about. But George will go all legal on us, saying the petition was from rebels, who are by definition traitors, and therefore have no legal status, and so they cannot petition. All they can do is throw themselves on the king's mercy. That attitude will sink the aspirations of the American moderates. What's left in the toolkit, then? Oh, well. For George, this is very much about God and duty and law and order, and he is right, and the Americans are wrong. He will issue a royal proclamation that the Americans are in open rebellion. For the Americans, the enemy had been Parliament. Now it's George, and that makes propaganda way easier for them. There will be plenty of satirical cartoons. The 1776 New England Almanac will be out. You can buy one today for 6,000 US bucks. The cover illustration is not that well done, but we have America depicted as a woman. She's being held down by two of George's men. Her top is down, revealing her girlish charms. The guy holding her ankles is lifting a dress to have a look at her heavenly honeypot. George is forcing tea down her throat while a couple of courtiers look on. The final figure in the picture is a dejected Britannia who is looking away, and she can't watch. We also see the patriarchal stuff on both sides. George is now a bad father, while the Americans are George's naughty children. Oh, yeah. Last time we heard stuff like that was James 2 and 7 with his ideas of personal rule. What is needed for an empire is something like a States General. That is, the various territories have their own legislature for local conditions that are representative to the Parliament in Westminster. The Americans weren't so much upset by the taxation, but that the taxation was through the English Parliament rather than their own assemblies. That then upset the English Parliament, who thought it was their dick that was swinging bigly. The Americans are challenging the right of Parliament and consider they should be answerable to the Crown directly. So everyone's upset. In all this, George was on the side of his Parliament. The rebellion then started up and George came in with his standard idea, crush it by force, but he's failed to see how many troops would be needed to do that. His Secretary of War had the right idea, a naval blockade. What, says George, besiege an entire country? Crazy idea. Standard practice in our time, my dear listener. Besieging a country with military bases and missiles, then starve them out using sanctions. And it's not just military bases and missiles. The US have got naval ships going all over the place, and they've got aircraft on them, and the world's full of American war machines. It doesn't work out that well, but it does cause a lot of misery in refugees. We should note here, though, that it's not only our guys in America who are revolting. Louisiana was transferred from France to Spain after the Seven Years' War. The Louisiana mob found Spanish rule to be shit because the Spanish said, "You lot can trade with us and nobody else." So the mob tossed over the governor and his lot and asked Louis XV, "Please take us back as a colony." The Spanish told Louis XV to stay out of it and went in to execute the rebels. Part of the problem for Spain was the dual nature of the population. You've got your pensionaries, these Spanish guys, and you've got your Creoles, American-born descendants of Spanish colonialists. Those Creoles certainly do not get the best jobs. The idea of not allowing any trade with anyone not called Spain was so that King Charles III of Spain could get the maximum cash out of the place. The idea of not letting Creoles into good jobs was to maintain maximum control over the government. This will actually work because Spain has got a lot of troops there and these guys are on reasonably fast rotation. Britain has been doing similar stuff, but it's not working in the 13 colonies because we've been whipping up the mob with some nice propaganda about all men being created equal and the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Yeah, Portugal tried something different with their colony in Brazil. They chartered companies and gave them a monopoly on trade to get more economic benefit for the state. I'm not sure why I'm telling you about the Spanish and Portuguese efforts in South America, because they'll all collapse in about 60 years anyway. They're successful right now, but they're not long-term successful. They're short-term stuff going on. It's just to say that George wasn't doing anything that other countries weren't doing. If only we had all listened to Walter Raleigh on colonisation all those years ago, but then the rich guys wouldn't have made all that money. Let's have the Americans read out that newly minted Declaration of Independence again. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Yeah. But that's actually the preamble, which comes in after the introduction. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political yada blah, with the point being that as we get the Declaration of Independence, the common smellies will pull down the statue of our magnificent George. Yeah, this is in America, of course, there. Yeah. So George's statue's been pulled down. Gee whiz. It's been turned from a dicky bird perch to, bullets. Yeah, they melted it down, turned it into bullets. Royal arms will be taken down, George's name will be removed from the government and legal documents, royal portraits are reversed or destroyed. Bring on mock trials and executions and funerals of George. Street and buildings might find their names changed. King Street will become State Street. King's College in New York will become Columbia. Not so big in the South, Georgetown will be unchanged. We actually don't know who it was named for. George II was the king when it was founded by George Gordon and George Beale. But who cares, because it will end up being in Washington, D.C., so we'll all just think it was named for George Washington. Georgetown in Queensland was founded during the marvellous reign of George III. 1.7 billion years ago, Georgetown, Queensland was in North America and was named for Gold Commissioner Howard St. George. But none of this is helping. Prince and Duke Streets will remain unchanged in Alexandria, Virginia. No, not everyone is Republic crazy. The start of the biff was great for Republicans. George can now be an evil king who sends troops against his people. Non-Republicans who just want to get back to a peaceful existence will be calling the British troops parliamentary troops rather than royal troops. It's all in the words, isn't it? Yeah. We dally around and fart around with words. Why can't we just all be honest? Tom Paine, though, wrote in his Common Sense that George was a hardened, sullen, tempered pharaoh, a royal brute who sleeps with American blood on his soul. Oh, dear. We never knew he was that bad, did we? The talking heads in Congress, though, are not accepting a motion that Georgia, not the ministry nor the parliament, is to be seen as the author of our miseries. No, it's the rich guys, you dickheads, but anyway, George won't help himself by disowning American rebels. British policy is now no trade with rebellious colonies. The British are also looking for mercenaries, and the place to get them right now is Germany. So the Americans, of course, will associate the German troops coming in with George. The Declaration of Independence, adopted on the 4th of July 1776, contained a lengthy criticism of George. So far as the Americans are concerned, they had already broken with Parliament, so this was all about breaking with George and making themselves, that is Congress, politically legitimate. The easiest way to sell misgovernment to the mob is to personalise it. So it all becomes George's fault. The Declaration then tosses everything at George. Some of the stuff the Americans were unhappy about included in their Declaration of Independence was done by the governors, not George. But that didn't matter. We're just going to blame George. And so, my dear listener, the US government started out as it meant to go, and that is not being truthful with the population. Of course, if you're American, then the saintly founding fathers told you nothing but the truth, and George was a total turd. Samuel Adams was on about George's catalogue of crimes. He misused his executive powers and, combining with Parliament, attacked the precious American liberties. So George was the very first human to attack America because he hated their freedoms. Oh, fuck, we hear that all the time too, don't we? It will go on to be a bit biblical, and well, that's a bit much for some of the other founding fathers, but they can't get it out because, well, they're dealing with religious people. So it's the message that will stick, the biblical stuff. It's sad, isn't it? So I say, God bless America.
We'll go from the mountains to the prairies and to the ocean wide with foam. So God rest, please let the America.
George will be very interested in activities associated with the war. What we might think of as trivialities. He is no Fred the Great. There'll be a new session of Parliament and George will reject conciliation with the Americans. That was what the mob wanted, but what George wants is to coerce them. He has again undermined American moderates. They're in there, they're trying to get this thing settled, but yeah, George wants Biff. Then George, with zero military experience, wants to be the glorious leader telling guys what to do. Oh, I've made him sound a bit too bad there. He wants his soldiers to show more vigour. George is so caught up with the American war that he will underrate reports that the Frenchies are planning an attack. Idiot. George's man, General George Burgoyne, will come up with a cunning plan. A fast march from Canada down to Albany, New York. At Albany, he can meet up with General Howe coming out of New York City and Barry St. Ledger coming down from the Mohawk River. That done, they have cut off New England from the southern colonies and it will be just a case of mopping up. It's a stroll in the park for Burgoyne and he's got a £10 bet that he'll have this done and dusted me back in London within a year. Okay, let's get this baby going. The message from London to General Howe and Barry St. Ledger won't be that clear. What they say, we don't quite understand this. So they won't be moving into support. That meeting won't happen. Bugger. Burgoyne then is on his Pat Malone trying to do it all by himself. In comes American Major General Horatio Gates and Burgoyne is stuffed at Saratoga, New York. Burgoyne will surrender, losing his £10 bet. In fact, George, if you could get your head out of your arse, then you would see that Louis XVI is sending guns and ammo to the Americans. They're in a proxy war against England, and, hey, here's the Treaty of Alliance, 1778. So when the Americans say that the Frenchies are their oldest ally, then, yeah, correct for a change. It's not only me being critical of George, he's copying it at home. But he is convinced that he is right, and right now he sees that he's been too lenient. He also has some sort of feeling of responsibility to Americans who want to stay loyal to Britain. Well, do a bloody deal, George. But no. Has George got any ideas? He sure does. Export American prisoners to India to be colonists there. Most of them will catch a filthy disease and die. And treat the American Navy, and I have to admit they're privateers, but treat them as pirates. Yeah, that's not helpful. It will take about 3 years of war for George to work out that conducting a war from Britain is a bad idea. You need to trust those who are on the spot to make the right decisions and conduct a war. Just the problem of delay to get the news in makes it all difficult. Having gotten the news, then you need to get it verified really fast, but it's tricky if you've got the Atlantic Ocean in between you and the action. And now the Frenchies have decided to declare war on us. In 1778, with Spain joining the next year, 1779. But George is up for it. He thinks any sign of weakness now would see the Irish rebel and the West Indies rebel, and he ain't having any of that. It was the surrender of Burgoyne that inspired Louis XVI to go full-on pardon with the Americans and declare war on England. Stupid, really, because 16 had inherited a big pile of crap from 15, but there you go. What 16 should be doing is paying down friggin' national debt. This will be a naval war, that is, between England, France and Spain. And it's going to happen all over the place. The English Channel, the Atlantic, the West Indies, North America, Gibraltar and around India. The Frenchies will do okay initially, but then it'll go pear-shaped for them. Bring on the Carlisle Peace Commission. This is a bunch of English led by the Earl of Carlisle, who have been authorised to go and talk concessions and peace with the American Congress. George had reluctantly agreed to it. The offer was self-rule and representation in Parliament. This means Britain would have to accept that compromise would end the conflict and the imperial relationship would have to change. So it's a big step forward. That's pretty much what the Americans wanted. Now, say the Americans, even though it does seem what they wanted, but no, they want it all by now. Full independence, thanks. George was not particularly in favour of anything. He thought that if you give the colony any little thing, then that colony will be back wanting more, more, more all the time. He was hoping that his soldiers would give the Americans a good kicking. Now, the Irish economy has been affected by the war, so they want more favourable commercial regulations. Competing British interests will, of course, oppose this. The Irish will respond with a boycott on British goods, and, oh dear, we might have another rebellion brewing. We'll have William Pitt leaping back into action for a big final farewell. In fact, I've probably put that badly, because really, he has been the voice of reason over this America stuff. Obviously, being the voice of reason meant the other politicians laughed at him. He kept saying the Americans will rebel unless we compromise with them. The other politician said, "Nah, don't be stupid, they won't rebel." Then when war broke out, he said, "You won't win a war, you need to do the talky stuff." And said, "Of course we're going to win the war." Yeah, bloody idiots. The Americans liked Pitt, but the English were not with him on his American views. Anyway, his big farewell was dying in the House of Lords. I'm not going to do his last words because there are several versions, meaning they're probably all bullshit. Probably all written after he was dead. He probably said something like, "Oh, geez, I feel a bit crook." Anyway, he was in the House of Lords at the time listening to the debate on the Duke of Richmond's motion for George to make peace with the Americans on any terms. And that was down to the Frenchies getting involved, and Pitt couldn't bear the thought that we'd back down because of the bloody Frenchies. So he was doing his usual thundering, but this time it was a bit too much, and he'll go down. They'll take him home to die, and we'll get bipartisan support for a big bash funeral at Westminster Abbey with a bloody big monument. George found it all a bit offensive, but that's just because he had a low opinion of politicians. Too bad politicians think politicians are just great. Pitt will get his bloody big funeral and his bloody big monument.
Somewhere beyond the sea, she is there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It's far, yes it is, beyond the star. It is near beyond the moon.
Yeah, a bit of Bobby Darin there, so he can sing George down to the dockyard so that George can gee up our brave boys ready for biff with the Frenchies. He'll also visit military camps at Windsor that have been set up ready to repel any Frenchie invasion. And there's cheering and waving, and George is once again popular with the Poms. But that is down to the mob no longer sympathising with the Americans because the Americans teamed up with the Frenchies. It's unthinkable. It's very bad form, Yanks. George has more sites to visit where large mobs of militia have joined in with army types, and there's more cheering and waving for George. Now, Catherine will be with George for some of the time on his travels, and certainly she'll be with him when they go to visit Lord Petre, the 9th Baron Petre. He is a descendant of Charles II and the actress Moll Davies. Robert Petre is a cattle tick, but he's also fond of fighting with the Catholic Church. We don't know what about because he destroyed his papers, and there'll be no speculation from me because there is so much to be annoyed about with the Catholic Church. It seems also that he wasn't that smart, but certainly smart enough to recognise that he wasn't that smart. And in my book, that's pretty darn smart. Still, he's got a reputation for being open and dignified. There was a lot of death around Robert and his mum. It's worth reporting on, I reckon. There's so much bloody death. His dad died of smallpox shortly after Robert was born. His great-uncle and granddad were executed as Jacobites in the 1745 shindig. Both mum's parents died when she was four, followed shortly by her brother and two sisters. Anyway, she ended up being a 15-year-old widow with baby Robert. Robert will donate decent amounts to the Catholics, who always need money, my dear, so they always need it. Yes, 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 they do. But he is still one of those patriotic, loyal to the crown types. He will raise a company of volunteers to go Frenchy bashing at the appropriate time. Part of Robert's patronage of Catholics will see one guy come up with the fragment hypothesis. That is to do with the Torah, or for us non-Jews, if you're a non-Jew, my dear listener, the first five books of the Old Book of Magic. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and never ever forget Deuteronomy, which is what you need to condone the genocide of the Palestinians. The fragment hypothesis kind of says, hey everyone, not only did each of these books have a different author, each book had multiple authors itself. Oh dear, say weirdo Christians, that can't be right. The whole thing was written by just one author, God. Yeah. I think I'm going to get off track if I keep going with that. We've met Bob Petre because while he isn't looking to make Catholic great again in England, he'd like it to not be illegal anymore. Right now, if Catholics do the Magic Catholic Show on the quiet, nobody much cares. But try and get a decent job and, well, that'll be a no. They are second-class citizens. Oddly enough, richer Catholics are doing okay out of this. They can't run for Parliament, so they don't have to find cash for bribes. Nor do they get good jobs, so they can get to stay home and manage their estates properly. That will mean they get rich. Let me really come to the point. It is time to reintegrate the senior Catholics, that is, nobles like Petre, back to the crown. This move, that is George and Charlotte going to stay with Petra, is a move towards that. Meanwhile, Prime Minister North is getting cheesed off and keeps banging on about how he wants to resign. No way, says George. Look at the opposition. They just keep coming up with stupid ideas. I need guys like you to make every assistance to help me. Now, that war in America, my dear listener, is dragging on. The war with the Frenchies and Spanish, similarly, is dragging on. The national debt is growing to the point where George can see it will no longer be possible for him to leave the country with a smaller debt than when he started. Parliament will vote to raise 12 new regiments to help the war effort. The idea is that the nobles will appoint and pay for the officers, and local councils will pay for the volunteers. George seems to be thinking here. He's not sure it's a good idea. He's considered whether these new guys will be professional. He also wants existing understrength regiments brought up to full strength before we go creating more. Then there's the case that he will have nobles who will have their own regiments, and that could lead to problems. I might get ideas. George would rather just keep on hiring German mercenaries, but that's going to cost too much. But, oh shit, the rumours are in that the Frenchies will be invading, so nobles want to raise volunteers. Yeah, see, that would make you all a bit too powerful, says George. Oh, dear me, it's just like the old feud days, George. We need a system where volunteers are enthusiastic about me, the king. That's what George wants. So, yes, get volunteers, but send them to existing regiments. He will allow the Duke of Ancaster to raise a regiment, but only if the Duke takes the rank of Major under a George-appointed general. George is staying involved in the war stuff. He's not domineering, it's more suggestions here and there. But he sees problems with loyalty in his cabinet, and that is loyalty to him. Perhaps he sees himself more as his own Prime Minister than North in all this. He'll ask North not to make any promises about handing out jobs without first referring the matter to himself, George. North, though, is not holding up well. Australian the war is probably the problem. George, though, wants to carry on with stability in his ministry, so he is just urging North to keep calm and carry on. That's where we'll be leaving it this week. Next week we might have a look at the American Navy. And yeah, I know they're privateers or pirates according to the English, but no, it's a Navy. For the time, it's a Navy. John Paul Jones, all that stuff. But that's next week. And that would, of course, be the other John Paul Jones, the Led Zeppelin John Paul Jones, to get us into some historical fiction. And this week, it's a movie, Jean du Barry, which is about the last mistress of Louis XV. Stars Johnny Depp, and he makes the movie. A great actor, isn't he, Johnny Depp, really? But apart from that, I couldn't really see quite the point of it. It makes us want to like Jean du Barry, the historical mistress of Louis. Really, I think you're better off with the TV series Marie Antoinette to show you the court of Versailles. But still a bit relevant to where we are in the podcast, because I think one of the reasons that the English didn't join the French and the Americans in rebelling against their government and their monarch is that George was rather moral and just quiet, wasn't he? He enjoyed a bit of gardening, that type of thing. Whereas Louis's court was totally decadent. But it's a pretty movie. If you want to watch it, off you go, Jean du Barry. But for us, it's a matter of what we go out with. And I think we might go out with a bit of Haim, The Wire. Hope to see you next week. Bye. It's the most important part that relationships will go through, and I give it up.
know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. You know there's no rhyme or reason for the way it turned out to be. I didn't go and try to change my mind, not intentionally. I know it's hard to hear me say it, but I can't bear to stay. And I just know, I know, I know, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway.